Hello, and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. I'm Diana Isaacs. I'm joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And in this episode, we have a bunch of updates we really want to share. I think we're going to start off with some Tandem updates, the insulin pump. So big news that recently they gained FDA approval for use in type 1 diabetes and pregnancy. And I think that is really huge. So this is based off of the CIRCUIT trial, which showed an amazing improvement in time in range in pregnant women with type 1 diabetes, which is a very difficult population to manage just because you've got these really tight goals, the time target of 63 to 140. But I think we weren't sure. I wasn't sure it was going to get the approval because to use it in pregnancy, it's not like you just set pregnancy mode. There's definitely some things they did in the trial to optimize time and range. But I think this really like gives us the confidence like, wow, we have an AID system now that's actually approved in pregnancy. Natalie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
I am super excited about this, right? We have been talking about having, you know, these ADA goals, right? And ACOG goals, fasting less than less than 95, 1 hour, less than 140, 2 hours, less than 120. And, you know, we should use AID systems and that all of the AID here wasn't approved. And so, you know, to have a system approved and to have Tandem have the guts to do the research also really makes a difference, right? So, but you're right, there were some nuances in the way they programmed the pump in order to drive those numbers down. And one of the things that they did was they kept it in what we call sleep mode all the time, which targets 112 to 120.
20.
Mm-hmm. Right? I'm like, oh, and 12 to 1, whoop, 20. And so it's targeting that tighter number. What it does to the system is it allows the system to increase basal. It just takes away that hourly bolus that the system not in sleep mode can do. And so it isn't without a special setting in it that does it, but we have people do that all the time. We know lots of the people that we see who are not pregnant have found that the Tandem system with that tighter sleep mode of 112 to 120 with those increases of basal has done really well and increased their time in range. So it's not like it's the first time we've seen this or done this. But I am excited because this allows us to say there is a system, the time in range went up significantly. And to me, that's everything.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is really good about this is now that it's officially FDA approved, that means the company can talk about it and also share best practices about it. So like you mentioned, the being in sleep mode all the time, that's really important. I think the key with that, though, is the person, if they are running higher, they should proactively give themselves a correction with their bolus calculator. For someone that is not doing that, sometimes auto corrections are very helpful. And so we still can individualize this, but for most, the sleep mode all the time is going to be helpful. The other thing that they did in this study is that after 20 weeks gestation, they looked at what the basal amounts were that the person was receiving and specifically set the basal rates to 20% higher than that. And so that allows the system to really run a bit more aggressively. And even though it's aiming for 112 to 120, many times we can actually get lower than that. And so, for example, we're really aiming for a fasting of less than 95. And that would be ideal. And of course, the range in this is not that, which is one of the reasons why I was a little surprised it got approved. But I think that the reality is it's still doing way better than anything else. It's doing better than a pump in manual mode. And it's certainly doing better than someone on multiple daily injections. And it's one of the questions we don't even really know. I mean, if someone can get this 70% plus time in range, is it a big deal if their fasting is like a tad bit, you know, above 95? You know, those are still things we're trying to figure out.
Absolutely. And their daytime numbers are so much tighter, right? The things that we do here in our practices, please look at your pump every 90 minutes to 2 hours and correct as needed. Please keep a really close eye after you eat, right? To really try to drive those post-meal numbers down. And if you think about it, if a person's sensitivity is set correctly, they should be able to treat it anytime. They should be able to treat every 30 minutes, every 15 minutes, a high glucose, and really not be concerned about hypoglycemia. If they say, oh no, if I can't do that, then I end up low. We know that we need to fix those that sensitivity, right? It's too aggressive. So we're really trying to balance. The other thing I think we need to think about is that when you look at a download, you know, and you see, when you look at the tandem download and you see some red lines and you see some increases, and people will say to me, oh, this is, it's working so hard. It's supposed to, right? Your car works hard when you drive 75 on the highway too. And that's okay, right? We want it to work hard. We want it to give insulin and take it away. And when we think about people with type 1 diabetes and our favorite poster of 42 factors, now we're adding pregnancy and hormones to it, right? Now we're adding, you know, I'm struggling with this, or I'm tired and I needed a nap today when I don't usually nap, and I'm walking a little bit less or more at different times, or however your life changes during your pregnancy, though the pump is going to turn off and on differently. It's going to increase basal maybe a more. And I think that we need to keep that in mind, that when we see people with pregnancy, that the pump should be going on and off. It depends on the day, right? It should be giving more, it should be suspending, it should be slowing, you know, reducing basal and then suspending if it's predicting lows. All of that is okay. And not to get scared if you see some red lines and if you see whatever. I think that's a big part of it too, is that we're comfortable with it, but a lot of clinicians aren't.
Yeah. And I think there's also some best practices too for correction factors, carb ratios, calculations to do. We have the original calculations, but then for intensifying settings, we really strengthen them. Like Tandem recommends using the rule of 330 for the carb ratio, 330 divided by the total daily insulin, and then the rule of 1580 divided by the total daily insulin for that correction factor. And it can even be, sometimes it needs to be even be more intensive than that. So I think I'm excited that now we can talk about this on label. And it's great. We've got an option to offer our pregnant patients with type 1 diabetes.
And ultimately, what are we trying to do? You know, grow babies as long as we can in utero and keep our moms and the babies healthy, right? So that's ultimately the goal. And this just gives us one more thing to offer to do that.
Right. And then one other Tandem update is they did announce this week that now the t-slim x2 integrates with the Dexcom g7 15 day officially. It kind of worked unofficially before, but now it's official. There is a software update that people are supposed to do, and that will allow it to work well, not be glitchy, have the 1 hour warm-up time as we would expect. So that's exciting. And then soon it should be on the Mobi soon, but right now it's the t-slim x2 that has that.
And it's interesting when we've added 15 to Omnipod, and we've added 15 to iLet, and we've added 15 now. And it's like, you think, okay, well, it's just one less sensor change a month. But when I talk to people about it, oh, the 15 days available now, would you like it? Yes. I mean, it's very interesting how excited people are. And I think that as a clinician, we need to remember always, always reduce burden. And so when we're trying to reduce burden, saying that's one extra sensor a month, that's 12 extra sensor insertions a year, you know, it's just one less thing for the person to have to do. What a wonderful thing to offer. So I don't know, you know, we've talked a little bit about the 10 day. It's not approved. The 15 day is not approved for peds yet. So 10 day is not going anywhere. So if someone says to you as a clinician, I really like the 10 day because of this, or my skin starts to get itchy or it starts to peel off, you know, I don't want the 15 day right now. We have full rein in saying, absolutely not, leave it alone. I do believe at some point in the future, 10 day will be approved for peds and go away. And, you know, I'm sorry, 15 day will be approved for peds and 10 day will eventually go away, right? They're not going to continue to offer two sensors if they don't have to. So I will see what happens in the future, but I do love the idea of having people so excited about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right. So we are going to switch gears now and totally different topic, although still related to type 1 diabetes, and that is teplizumab. So new news with teplizumab. So previously, people 8 and over could receive teplizumab, which is approved to delay basically delay the progression of type 1 diabetes, given to stage 2 to delay the progression to stage 3, which is full-on symptomatic type 1 diabetes. But now it's approved down to ages 1. So that's a big difference. That means a lot of kids will be eligible that previously weren't before. Natalie, what do you think about that?
So we're asking people to screen, right? So if I have type 1, we write in our notes every day, you know, you should be screening your child around the ages of 2, of 4 to 5, of 9 to 11, or 11 to 13, depending on which guidelines you're following. This is when you should be screening. But when you're screening them the first 2 times, there was nothing to do but know, right? And so even though knowing reduces the risk of DKA, right? It goes from 40 to 60% down to, 2 to 6% DKA at diagnosis. And DKA is a horrible thing. And outcomes are poorer when you end up with type 1 diagnosed in DKA, right? We know this. We've talked about it in the past. A lot of people were like, well, there's nothing to do. I'll watch. I'll be okay. I'll never miss a diagnosis in my own child. None of that is true. We actually see it all the time, right? We're all busy. We're not paying attention. It's warm out. Your kid starts drinking more and you miss it, right? Now that there's a drug approved to delay the onset, I think more people will be willing to screen earlier. And this is super important.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, sometimes some people get stuck on the data. So overall, the data shows a 2-year delay. But as we've talked about before, it's so much more than that. Because first of all, there are people that respond and have much longer delay. And there's some people with less. But I've recently been really impressed hearing from some of the families with a shorter. So they didn't even make it to the 2 years, but they were still happy they got the teplizumab, because when they did develop stage 3, they only needed like a long acting insulin at first, or maybe even a little bit of like inhaled insulin to start, like really little amounts and a very gradual introduction into type 1 diabetes, as opposed to this, like you said, full-fledged, like, oh my gosh, you're in DKA. This is like very traumatic. So I think there's so many benefits. And of course, we can only offer it if someone is screened and they know they have these autoantibodies. So I think it's great, the expanded age. I'm thrilled about that. Even though I do mostly adults, I'm still thrilled.
and to your point, you and I are educating adults about getting their children screened, right? Yeah. The kids aren't my patients, and they're not going to be, even if they're screened positive, because they're going to pediatric endo, right? But we need to counsel on screening to every person. Like we counsel on cholesterol, we counsel on blood pressure, we counsel on exercise. It's part of what we should be doing every day. You know, that 57 month, delay versus the, 20 some month delay, 27 month delay, means a lot though, to a lot of people. And mm-hmm. What we're going to find in the long run is precision medicine. The more we learn about screening, about what antibodies were positive, about how many antibodies, I think we're going to come up with more different and more options to treat and delay than we have now, right? So this is the first and only right now. I think we're going to see more in the future, and I'm excited about it. I think the United States is slowly gaining hold of this idea that we should be screening and we should see more of it, and hopefully address a lot of this ahead of time.
Yeah, definitely. Completely agree. And then just another bit of news, minor news, but so we have been, kind of anxiously awaiting teplizumab to gain approval for stage 3 type 1 diabetes. So new onset and protecting those beta cells. It had an expedited review. However, the review will no longer be going down the expedited path. So it still will hopefully be on course. It just may potentially not be as fast as we had hoped for. So it's just, something to be aware of, because I was like hoping it'd be any day that we would get it and be able to kind of expand indications. Because now it's like, oh man, someone realizes they're in stage 3 and they're like, oh, I missed my window. I missed my opportunity. But that would really open it up for eligibility. But hopefully it's not never. It's just, it might take a little bit longer on that.
It's going to have to go to committee, and the data looks good. We can hope for the best, and more to come, I think, is the best way to put it right now.
Yeah. More to come. Yes. But at least we got the younger age indication. So that is very exciting. All right. And then our last kind of piece we wanted to share is related to the SURMOUNT-5 study that is with tirzepatide versus semaglutide in people with obesity. And there was a recent post hoc analysis that has some pretty interesting data about pre-diabetes, if we can use that term. We probably shouldn't use that term, but I just did. But Natalie, you want to share what the kind of the new data shows?
Absolutely. So when we look at, like, so let's talk about this SURMOUNT 5, right? A post hoc analysis with obesity and pre-diabetes. So they went back and said, what else can we pull out of this data? What else do we see here? And that's what post hoc is, right? It wasn't designed in the beginning, but now we're going to go back and look, which I sometimes we see more interesting or as interesting things in post hoc analysis as we do in the initial data, right? We're excited about the initial data, but the background basically was like, hey, let's look at this as a key goal. Like, can we, right? Can we prevent that progression of type 2 diabetes? And we talked a little bit about staging, you know, Diana, actually, let's like that pre-diabetes, we're actually wanting to stage it. You know, we have stage 1, 2, and 3 with type 1 diabetes. The goal, and all clinicians are really into this right now and buying into the idea that we would call pre-diabetes stage 1 because the cardiovascular risk is already there. But can we prevent that staging, that further staging from pre-diabetes with obesity to not diabetes, right? What and look at the medication. So that's what this is. In SURMOUNT 5, once weekly tirzepatide at the maximum tolerated dose of 10 milligrams or 15 milligrams was compared to semaglutide 1.7 or 2.4. Remember, those are the obesity doses, right? So this was with obesity, resulted in significantly greater body weight reduction, right, in adults living with obesity without type 2 diabetes. So let's look at that, though, and say, let's look at the changes in glycemia outcomes with that maximum tolerated dose compared to the maximum tolerated dose of semaglutide. So so that's what was looked at. 425 participants as having defined one or greater than one fasting lab value. So basically, they qualified as what we now call pre-diabetes, right? Mm-hmm. And what were those results? I mean, that's really, and it's 72 weeks. So Diana, do you want to share the results now that I've gone through the, hey, basically what is SURMOUNT 5?
Yeah. So for the ones that had, you know, kind of this diagnosis of pre-diabetes, they showed that the group that was randomized to tirzepatide, 89.9% of them had quote unquote normal glycemia. So meaning like their A1C was back to under 5.7, their fasting was less than 100, like they no longer had prediabetes. And in the semaglutide group, it was 76.2%. So it was a little bit more in the tirzepatide. Either way, I'm pretty impressed that this high percentage of people was able to essentially kind of put their prediabetes or early stage 2 diabetes into remission with these medications. And I think this is really powerful data because we've seen, and this is one of the reasons why we want to reclassify prediabetes, it is in itself a cardiovascular risk factor. And so by being able to address this, we hopefully are decreasing someone's cardiovascular risk and reducing those cardiovascular events. So I think this is really powerful data and also shows the potential benefits of treating obesity earlier, not waiting until people have this like end stage organ damage, but treating it to prevent these complications.
Absolutely. And I think what if we can call pre-diabetes stage 1 type 2 diabetes, then we can hopefully get better indications for medications and we can expand the use of some of these medications. Because remember, these people, because they don't have a diagnosis of diabetes, you know, they get their medicines for free because it's a SURMOUNT trial, right? That's a wonderful thing, right? But ultimately, a lot of people don't have obesity coverage, right? So we can get some through now with sleep apnea, right? We can get some through for kidney disease with, right? But we really, really struggle for a lot of people getting coverage. And ultimately, I can see this really trying to shift that focus into, wait, these people do have cardiovascular risk. We can give it to them early. We can prevent these things from happening. We can, you know, that is a big part of it. But ultimately, In this postdoc hoc analysis, a greater proportion of tirzepatide-treated patients with obesity and prediabetes at baseline reverted to normal glycemia, right? That's really what this is. Compared with semaglutide, greater improvements in glycemia, estimated of insulin resistance, which I think is an interesting, I'm sorry, insulin sensitivity, and body weight were also observed with tirzepatide. So, okay, great. But we have to remember, everyone doesn't tolerate either drug. So we need all the options to still continue to say, yes, this showed a greater benefit with tirzepatide, but some people can't tolerate it. Some people can't tolerate semaglutide. Some people, and so what this tells me is, you know, what am I looking for? How do I do it? And if it isn't tolerated, boy, the people using semaglutide did quite well too, just not quite as well. Isn't that a great way to think about it?
No, it is an absolutely great way to think about it. Interestingly, the dropout rates were actually a little bit higher from GI side effects with the semaglutide group versus tirzepatide. But the thing is, it's like not statistically, like it's not powered to really detect that. And then when you compare to like other trials where they went head to head, like SURPASS-2, there wasn't a difference in side effects. So kind of like you said, sometimes people do tolerate one drug more than the other. And it's good to have options. Both performs very well.
Wonderful.
All right. Well, this has been a great discussion. Thanks for sticking with us on this variety of topics. And that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thanks, everyone.